Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I am John Iderola, and we are now broadcasting from day 2 of the apparently all signs point to right-wing motivated mass assassination attempt against basically every high-profile Democratic politician, member of media, even a celebrity that has affiliated themselves with the anti-Trump cause. We're going to be breaking down all the updates to that. And then I think perhaps even more importantly, a little bit later on, we're going to be talking about how Donald Trump and the right-wing media have messaged about these issues. I made a prediction on yesterday's show about what they would do. We'll be playing that and seeing if I was right or if I was wrong a little bit later on. We're also joined on this show by two awesome guests. A new launched podcast, Underdog, is taking a deep dive into the Beto O'Rourke-Ted Cruz Senate race. We're going to be talking with the host of that podcast and trying to get an idea of how this very important Senate race might play out in just about 2 weeks' time, actually. And later on, Mark Pinsley is running for a state Senate seat in Pennsylvania. And as so many Democratic candidates have, he has been the target of factually inaccurate advertising. We're going to break down how that actually came about, how consequential it is, and what it's like to run for a state legislative race in an era of nationalized politics of the sort that we're seeing. In terms of news later on, we're going to be talking about last night's debate between Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis. Gillum with some amazing lines that we're going to break down. We've got more for you as well, but I want to jump right into the big news of the day. Today, more pipe bombs or mail bombs or glass bombs, depending how what you read, they're described in different ways, but they are continuing to be sent to a number of different individuals in different parts of the country. These two most recent pipe bombs, one was addressed to former Vice President Joe Biden, the other to actor Robert De Niro, found in Delaware and New York City. And so according to law enforcement, this is not simply a copycat, or if it is, it's a very accurate one, because a law enforcement official said the envelope and printed address labels on the package sent to Mr. De Niro were similar to those on explosives sent to former President Barack Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and others. So we've now added even more people to the running list of those that whoever this terrorist, this individual or group is, attempting to kill high-profile Democratic politicians, and even people affiliated with it. So look, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, elected officials, now Joe Biden, you know, previously with Barack Obama, you have former head of the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, others sort of getting involved in this web, but even Robert De Niro, a guy who I don't think it's irresponsible to say is being targeted because of his condemnation of Donald Trump. We'll get back to that in a little bit more. The web just continues to expand. And I want to get into the specifics of the bombs just a little bit more, because I have heard a number of right-wingers saying that these aren't actual bombs, or the idea was never to actually hurt anyone. That is a level of, I don't know, attempted good faith towards the terrorists that I don't think I've ever seen from right-wing media before, and we will never see again, especially if the terrorist happens to be of Muslim descent. The idea that when a bomb is sent to an individual, they say, you know, until it's proven beyond a reasonable doubt, we don't know that they were actually trying to do anything bad. I don't think that I've ever heard that before in American history. But in this particular case, law enforcement officials are saying that the bombs sent to prominent Democrats and CNN yesterday were packed with shards of glass. So the idea was not just to blow up these bombs, and they were in fact bombs, but they were packed with materials to produce as much shrapnel and collateral damage around the explosion as possible, either to ensure a kill of the primary target, to take out members of their household or people who work in their office, or possibly just kill as many postal workers as possible. Now, in addition to the new bombs that we talked about earlier, last night news broke that more had been sent to Maxine Waters. I think in yesterday's The Damage Report, that hadn't yet been reported. So Maxine Waters, congresswoman, an obvious constant target of Donald Trump's rage, has been targeted by multiple bombs. And I have also heard, this has not been confirmed yet, so check into this, but the Cannon House office building on the Hill has been evacuated. It is almost certainly the case that a building like that would have many people working in them, but one of them is Nancy Pelosi. And so I guess it had been a little bit surprising up until this point that she had not been targeted yet. It is possible at this point that they were. We don't know for sure, but the building has been evacuated. I would assume, by the way, that law enforcement and the security services for these various individuals are probably on an elevated state of concern. And there's even been false positives, I guess. The governor of New York had a package that they believed was something suspicious, a bomb. It turned out not to be a bomb. But in the rest of these cases, the initial accounts have actually come true, and they were explosive devices. So with that said, those are the updates. But I want to talk about the way that the president and the right-wing media has addressed what's going on here. And I'm going to lump in a little bit of the centrist media as well, because they're both sides' rhetoric has been distressing too. On yesterday's program, I made the prediction, this is before Donald Trump had said anything about these bombings yet, that he would not take a strong stand against what appears to be the most widespread coordinated attempt at mass assassinations in American history. And I guess at that point, it was at least a little bit risky because we didn't know for sure. And who knows, maybe his handlers would rein him in and he'd be the president he needs to be. Maybe he'd become president that day, as people love to joke. So here is what I said on yesterday's program. Now, supposedly later on today, he is going to say something. I'm going to make a prediction, and I hope that I'm wrong. I think he is going to advance his narrative of left-wing violence, and he is going to find some way to do that, even though all of the targets of these attempted acts of terrorism have been Democratic politicians and members of the media that have been attacked on the right as if they are a part of the left. Okay, so let me just first say, I find it pretty unbearable when people in the media show videos of them making predictions. But I think that in this case, it is important. Because the reason I made that prediction, the reason many of you might have felt like there was a good chance it would come true, is because of all that we've learned about Donald Trump. And not just Donald Trump, but the relationship that he has with the right media and his base. So I made that prediction. Now, I'm going to read a couple of quotes that he said at his rally last night. And then we're going to talk about what was in those quotes and what was not in those quotes. So here's a few things that Donald Trump said. Those engaged in the political arena must stop treating political opponents as being morally defective. No one should carelessly compare political opponents to historical villains, which is done often. It's done all the time. It's got to stop. We should not mob people in public spaces or destroy public property. So again, the concern, and I think it's an understandable concern, is that someone is attempting to kill people. And he goes back to, don't mob people in public places. Don't spit on someone in a restaurant. Don't scream at them at a Kroger or whatever. That is what Donald Trump chose to talk about. He also said, don't compare people to historical villains. So he's saying, don't call people Nazis, even though there are multiple literal Nazis and neo-Nazis running as Republicans in the primaries and the general election in this cycle. So on the eve of an incredibly well-coordinated mass attempt at political terrorism, domestic terrorism here in the US, he is instead doing exactly what I predicted. He is talking about Republicans being shouted at and Republicans being called Nazis, because that is the main concern. He goes on to say, the media also has a responsibility to set a civil tone and to stop the endless hostility and constant negative and oftentimes false attacks and stories. So if it was not clear enough already, CNN, which was the target of one of these bombs, you are at fault. You are the reason that you were almost blown up. He is literally blaming the victim in this case, while, let's note, not even naming the victim. He goes on to say, this is not just an offhand comment. Now it's on Twitter, the most, I guess, the most important avenue for expression by Donald Trump. A very big part of the anger we see today in our society is caused by the purposefully false and inaccurate reporting of the mainstream media that I refer to as fake news. It has gotten so bad and hateful that it is beyond description. Mainstream media must clean up its act fast. So when someone tries to blow up CNN, it is CNN's fault. Okay? And if they don't clean up their act, hey, maybe someone will blow them up. That's just a thing that might happen. Now, what's interesting is that in that tweet and in his rally performances, he did not name Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Maxine Waters, CNN, all of the people that had been targeted. He didn't name any of them. There was no expression of individualized specific compassion or concern for any of the people that were almost blown up. That, again, has got to be a historical first when it comes to a terror attack or an attempted terror attack in America. A complete lack of concern about them. And by the way, sources are also saying he didn't reach out to any of the attempted victims here. So all of these people, despite the fact that he's got them on his phone, he could call Barack Obama anytime he wants. Someone tried to murder the last president of the United States, and the current president of the United States doesn't even feel like it's worth DMing him about. And so don't actually acknowledge any of the specific targets. Instead, pivot to blaming the literal victims themselves for the violence that almost certainly one of your supporters is instigating. That is what he is doing, and he is being backed up at every stage by right-wing media. On Fox News yesterday, they had guests on saying that this was probably a left-wing stunt to get higher turnout in the midterms. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. But Fox News, a legitimate news organization, is just running with it. Rush Limbaugh and others on Twitter were specifically saying that this is probably a false flag. So you no longer need to go to Alex Jones. Sure, he's off YouTube, doesn't matter. Just go to Rush Limbaugh, go to Laura Ingraham, all of that. The same exact thing. And in the same way that Donald Trump did, do you know what Sean Hannity's coverage of these historic attempted acts of domestic terror were? He attacked Hillary Clinton and Maxine Waters for their rhetoric. So someone tried to murder these two high-profile female politicians, and he attacked the victims themselves. Now, a little bit later on the show, we're gonna have a response from Maxine Waters, but let's just acknowledge that has this ever happened before? Such utter lack of concern where the right-wing media cannot even, for one news cycle, pretend to care about domestic terror attacks. They couldn't even get through one show. Some of these people don't even have to do a full hour, and they couldn't do it. They could not manage it. They couldn't go one day on Twitter without blaming the victims. And so if you are out there, if you're the bomber, do you feel like, maybe I shouldn't do this? Maybe Donald Trump doesn't actually support this? Is that actually the message that you're getting? And I understand that you're not supposed to imply anything about the motivations of the person who did the bombing. And many people will say, we don't know, we should just wait and find out. And sure, we will wait and we will find out. But when all of the people who've been targeted are Democratic politicians, the specific targets of Donald Trump's ire constantly, whether it's Maxine Waters or De Niro, I mean, look, if you were out there and you were attempting to come up with an enemies list based purely on Donald Trump's rhetoric, who hasn't yet been hit on that list that you would have put together? I'm honestly trying, I guess Michael Avenatti hasn't had a suspicious package show up. He should probably be concerned because he's just about the only high profile individual in America that Donald Trump regularly talks about that has not received a package like this, filled with shards of glass and explosive materials. All the rest, even if it's someone who just once said F Trump on an awards show, or if it's a congresswoman that to a random American should just be a random person of Congress. There are literally hundreds, and yet Maxine Waters is the one that is targeted. Does anyone question why that is? We know exactly why that is. We know exactly why this list of targets has been put together in the way that it is. The only silver lining is that so far, none of the devices have actually claimed a life.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
But we're in day two. God only knows what day three will bring. Okay, with that, we are gonna take a short break. When we come back, we're gonna be joined by an awesome guest, gonna break down some of the specifics of the Senate race in Texas, Beto O'Rourke versus Ted Cruz. We are in the last weeks of this race. How is it gonna play out? We'll try to figure it out after this. Okay, so look, this midterm election has a number of extremely high profile, super high stakes elections. But possibly the one that's got me most invested is Beto O'Rourke versus Ted Cruz in Texas. Super important that Ted Cruz ends up losing. But as much as I care about the result, I don't know all the specifics. I haven't been in Texas for a while. So I'd like to be joined on the show now by the host of a new podcast, Underdog, who's been tracking this race as in-depth as anyone. Eric Benson, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
It's good to have you here. So this is a race that I definitely care about. You guys have chosen to profile it on your podcast. So tell me a little bit about that choice and also about what this new podcast is all about.
Sure. Well, you know, there've been a ton of profiles of Beto O'Rourke at this point, magazine profiles. It's been a lot also with Ted Cruz, but we thought doing a podcast and really having the intimacy of audio, in the truck with Beto, talking to Texans, you know, from the border, the Rio Grande Valley area, 400 miles north in Waco, even farther north in Dallas, and just kind of getting to kind of see the breadth of the state. You know, podcasting was a really powerful way to tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like it. Now, I lived in Texas. I lived in Austin for about 6 years, but I've been gone for longer than that and didn't spend much time in other parts of the state. As an outsider and in the media, what might I or other people be missing about the dynamics of this race that you guys have been able to uncover?
Well, I think the big thing that I think about this race is it's really two parallel elections that are happening. You know, Beto O'Rourke is running a campaign unlike past statewide Democrats have run in Texas. And by that, I mean, he's running a kind of unabashedly progressive Democratic campaign. You know, the tendency in red states, and Texas has been no different, is to run this kind of triangulating centrist campaign where you say, I'm not sure about how I feel about abortion rights, or, guns are great. But, you know, I'm also for universal health care. You know, Beto is running, I think, a campaign that you could run in California or New York. And he's speaking to an electorate and hoping an electorate turns out that really hasn't in past statewide elections in Texas. So he's counting on a big turnout of the Latino vote. He's counting on young people to vote in greater numbers than they voted for in past statewide elections. You know, and on the other side, Ted Cruz is speaking to the electorate that has shown up for Texas elections. So it's a conservative Republican electorate and an older electorate.
So I'm curious then, that seems like a perfectly accurate read of his strategy. I mean, what do you think, based on what you've seen? Obviously, we know what the polls are like at this point, but what do you think about that strategy? Betting on, like, for instance, in Texas, the Latino vote to turn out when historically that has not been the case for Democrats in Texas. Do you think that this might be the time, this might be the opportunity?
Well, a Democrat hasn't won a statewide race in Texas since 1994. So I think there's a sense that, you know, trying something new is a good idea. You know, past candidates have tried this kind of centrist triangulating approach, and they haven't come close to winning. So he's trying a totally different strategy. And he's trying a different strategy at a time where the state continues to change. The state is becoming more Latino by the day. The state is getting younger in terms of the electorate. And yeah, he's making this gamble that those people are going to show up enough for him to win this time.
So I also want to talk about like the particular role of a senator in Texas. Now, Texas is a gigantic state, big population. It's got huge rural areas. It's got cities like Dallas and Austin and Houston. Obviously, there's huge differences between those. In Texas, what do people expect out of a senator in terms of policy, but also in terms of presentation? Because to me, Ted Cruz seems like kind of a weird fit in terms of how he comports himself, the unwillingness of him to defend himself against the attacks of Donald Trump during the primary and all of that. But do Republicans in Texas still see him as sort of matching what the Texas vibe, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think he's really tried to play that up this campaign. You know, his slogan is "Tough as Texas." I don't know if you'll remember John Cornyn, who's the senior senator in Texas, who's also a Republican, ran this ad that got shared a lot on the internet, "Big John," and it was like John Cornyn in a cowboy hat riding a horse.
I remember.
River.
I remember.
Yeah. So yeah, if there is we in our second episode, we have this longtime Democratic consultant named Jack Martin on, and he says, look, the Republicans have done a really good job wrapping themselves in the Texas flag. And that's been a Republican strategy to win, but to create a perception that being a Texan and being a Republican are the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you're right, Cruz is, you know, Cruz is from Houston. Cruz isn't someone who's, you know, the kind of anyone's stereotype of this kind of swaggering Marlboro man Texan. what Cruz has been very good at is making himself kind of an avatar for, you know, hard right conservative values. Yeah. And when you go to a Cruz rally and you talk to people, that's what they tell you. You know, I was at a Cruz rally less than 2 weeks ago, and people were talking about how he's, you know, they're voting for him because of freedom and liberty. I was pretty struck. There wasn't a lot of talk about kind of him personally, the kind of qualities that he's a great role model or anything like this. But I think we're at that moment in politics where things are polarized and very ideological, and he's made himself into the kind of the conservative in Texas. You know, there was a time when I think, you know, in Texas, you would expect a senator to go to Washington and bring back a lot of federal programs. I mean, this is, you know, the most famous senator in Texas history. Lyndon Johnson was the master of this. We're at a point now where a lot of the Texas electorate wants a senator to go to Washington and kind of gum up the works of Washington, and Ted Cruz has done that.
So amongst Republican voters in Texas, is there no real concern about Lion Ted and the feud between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump? I know that people have been, there's billboards with the tweets of Donald Trump attacking Ted Cruz. Is that largely being ignored by Republicans?
You know, I think so. I think so too. If you look at Ted Cruz's favorability rating among Republicans, it's over 90%. It's the only politician that I see in those polls who's the governor of Texas is Greg Abbott, who's also a Republican, is quite popular. But Donald Trump is really popular, and Donald Trump has more. When you look at a poll and people say they're really enthusiastic or just kind of enthusiastic, Trump has higher really enthusiastic numbers than Cruz. But there was a bit of a dip in the polling for Cruz during the Republican primary when he and Trump were really going at it and when he refused to endorse Trump at the beginning. But I think that's really now all been forgotten. I think Cruz, and you know, if you're voting for Cruz, you're voting for Trump.
Okay. One last question for you. Prediction?
Well, you know, you can't make a prediction that Beto's going to win because no one's done it and no one's turned out this electorate. But I think when I ask Beto about the polling, you know, what he says is he doesn't think the polling's picking up all of these voters who haven't voted very often in the past. And his rallies have been attended more than, you know, any other candidate in anyone's memory in Texas. There's clearly an enthusiasm for him. So will that translate to this group that polls aren't picking up? You know, it's possible. We're seeing huge early voting numbers in Texas. It's unclear kind of where that early voting is coming from, Republicans, Democrats. But, you know, he wanted a high turnout election, and it looks like he's going to get a high turnout election.
Okay, well, we will certainly be watching here in California with bated breath to see the result of that race. Eric Benson, host of the Underdog Podcast, thank you for joining us.
Great, thanks so much, John.
Thank you. And to you watching, you can, of course, follow the remaining episodes of the podcast before that election and get continual updates about that race and the specifics of it and all that we might not get to here on the Damage Report. That said, we are going to take a break. We come back. Maxine Waters responds to being targeted by an attempted act of domestic terrorism and much more for you. Welcome back to the show, everyone. During the break, we were talking about the impending release of Red Dead Redemption 2, but I'm not going to talk about it on the show more than I just have. I really want to, but I'm not going to. I'm going to turn back to the big issues we have facing our country, including domestic terror. Maxine Waters has been the target of multiple pipe bombs now sent by, we don't know, nobody can guess. There's no reason to believe that they have any particular political affiliation or desires or anything like that. She was just chosen at random out of hundreds of congresspeople. But she has been the target, and she responded to that in her, I would say, characteristic style.
I don't know whether the bombs are real or not, but we should not crawl under the bed, close the doors, not go out, be afraid to go to rallies, whatever. We have to keep doing what we're doing in order to make this country right. That's what I intend to do. And as the young people said, I ain't scared.
Okay, look, that's an awesome response coming from anyone, but particularly from Maxine Waters. That is a great response because it's not just strong. It is strong in the face of very real danger. Like, they tried to murder her, and this is not the first time that she's been targeted. And again, we can't just pretend that this exists just floating in the ether. It's not connected to any political developments or anything like that. Donald Trump himself regularly talks about Maxine Waters, even when she's not in the news for anything. He will just bring her up at a rally, calling her a low IQ individual because she's African American. We understand the subtext. We know that that is an insult he only uses against African American individuals. And so he does that, and he continually talks about her. And we can't forget his tweet months ago where he said, be careful what you wish for, Maxine Waters. And look, it is possible that whoever has sent her these bombs doesn't know about that and doesn't know anything about Donald Trump or his feud with Maxine Waters or how great of an applause line it is to attack her at a Trump rally. Maybe the person setting the bombs doesn't know any of that. Or maybe they do. And maybe they understand how much Trump supporters hate her because their dear leader has told them to. And thankfully, to this point, when she was targeted months ago, when there were all those death threats and people saying that they were going to hang her from a tree on her voicemail, even up to today when packages are coming in attempting to murder her, she is still standing strong against that. And God, I hope that no one is successful because it is likely that she will continue to be targeted. Now, with that said, let's turn to another big story that broke yesterday. Donald Trump does not take things seriously. He certainly does not take even serious things seriously, like our national secrets. And the New York Times has now broken a story that, according to multiple sources familiar with it, multiple countries' spies are listening in on his phone calls because he refuses to do even the bare minimum necessary to secure that sort of information. American spy agencies say that they've learned that China and Russia have both been eavesdropping on the president's cell phone calls. Now, there's human sources inside those governments and also communications that have been intercepted between those officials. So you have both sort of, I guess, first person accountings from inside of those countries, but you don't necessarily have to trust those. They could be sort of just attempting to talk up their capabilities. But we actually have found out that they have been spreading information talked about on Donald Trump's phone calls, that these foreign officials have been communicating with each other about it. Now, why is this happening? Well, officials say that the president has two official iPhones that have been altered by the NSA to limit their abilities and vulnerabilities, and a third personal phone that is no different from hundreds of millions of iPhones in use around the world. Now, Mr. Trump keeps the personal phone because, unlike his other two phones, he can store his contacts in it. So he has been given two iPhones that you can use, and you can make phone calls, and you can make texts, and you can go on the internet, and you can lie in tweets and all of that, but he can't store his contacts. And so because of that, he just decides, I'm just gonna do whatever I want. I'm gonna use my personal phone. And sure, if I'm talking about trade policy, or if I'm talking about foreign policy, if I'm talking about exactly the sort of materials that China and Russia desperately want to have access to, I'm just gonna talk about it late at night when I'm talking to one of my donors, or maybe I call up Sean Hannity and I have a little chat. You know, I'm feeling an energy high from the Big Mac I just scarfed down. I'm gonna talk about sensitive materials and I don't care who actually finds out about it. Now, his aides have apparently repeatedly warned him that his cell phone calls are not secure, and they've told him that Russian spies are routinely eavesdropping on the calls, but he just doesn't care. Aides say that he's been pressured into using the secure landline more, but he still refused to give up his iPhones. White House officials say, and God, is this sad, they can only hope he refrains from discussing classified information when he is on them. But as sad as that is, the state that we're in as a country, where we just have to hope that the president just doesn't mention certain things because he can't be bothered to actually be responsible when it comes to spreading national security secrets and information. Catherine Rampell also tweeted this out. White House officials say that they have further confidence that he was not spilling secrets because he rarely digs into the details of the intelligence he has shown and is not well versed in the operational specifics of military or covert activities, which I love. That is a complex way of saying we don't have to worry about him spreading the most secure or sensitive information because he doesn't understand it himself. He actually can't repeat it because he can't be bothered to read the materials, and complex details about the way operations are actually put into effect, the way that they are conducted, he doesn't get that stuff. So the thing that might secure our secrets is his own stupidity and ignorance. And then I think of the Russian and Chinese spies listening to this phone call, just desperately, they're talking about a raid that's gonna go on in Yemen. This dude doesn't know anything. He's given us nothing. How frustrating of a job must that actually be? But there are things that he talks about that are important. Apparently, the Chinese are spying in because they want to understand what moves they need to make or shouldn't make when it comes to the escalating trade war between us. And he loves to talk about that stuff, especially with his businessman friends. And so China is getting very important information. And it, look, from like pragmatically, forget that, you know, I despise Donald Trump and I don't want him to be president. If you want him to do well, if you want America to come out on top in these, albeit unnecessary, trade negotiations and the trade war that he's developing, even if that is your, if you're a Republican, do you want him spreading information to China before we go to the negotiating table, before he sits down with their leaders? Do you really think that that is where we should be at as a country? And it's not like Republicans haven't in the past cared about the sensitivity of material and how materials, government secrets are being secured. They lost their S over Hillary Clinton's email server. They didn't think that she should be putting that on a private server. That's government information. That needs to be secured by the government. How is she doing this in that way? But even in that case that Republicans still talk about to this day, it was still a secure server. It was just a private one. Donald Trump looks at two phones on a nightstand, the one that's secured and the one that's not. And like a petulant child, even though he's been warned, he still picks up the personal unsecured phone. That is how little he cares about our nation's secrets, that he can't even be bothered to remember a phone number. He'd rather just get his contact out of the one that's spilling secrets to the Chinese and the Russians. That is where we're at as a country. Okay, we're going to take another break. When we come back, joined by another guest, a Democratic candidate, target of false and malicious advertising. We'll be breaking down how that's played out after this. There has been more than enough false advertising in this midterm cycle to go around, and I want to be joined on the show now, actually, by Mark Pinsley, a candidate who has been the target of exactly that sort of advertising. Mark, welcome to the Damage Report. I want to talk to you about what actually ended up happening, where the blame lies. So your campaign was the target of some advertising that alleged things about your finances that were not actually true. Can you give us the rundown on that?
Yeah, so basically what ended up happening was on Thursday the 11th, my opponent had put out a mailer, and the mailer said that I wasn't paying my business taxes, which was completely false. So what ended, immediately I called my accountant just to make sure that I was paying my taxes. I was 99.9% sure I was paying, but you know, I wanted to make sure. So I talked to him and he said, clearly you're paying your taxes. He called the Department of Revenue and here in Pennsylvania, confirmed that we were paying our taxes. And then we immediately put out a press conference the next morning calling out my competitor, saying that this was lies.
So he comes out with this false information, the campaign comes out with this false information, you've easily debunked it. But
yes.
How worried are you now going forward that more people might have heard the attack than the correction? Like how worried are you about the effect this might have on your race?
Well, I'm always worried about that, of course. We've done our best to, you know, get our message out there. He has not yet apologized. So, in fact, we have a lawsuit that we're going to court on this Monday to force him to apologize. So you have to be worried about these kind of things.
Yeah. Well, look, I hope that he does. In the past, generally, candidates will at least give like a very shallow version of, you know, I'm sorry that happened or whatever. But we're living under Donald Trump, so there's less of that going around maybe.
That's right. Actually, we say they're lying because they're losing.
I hope that is the case. So hopefully viewers now know what the truth is in this matter. Yep. But I'm sure that you would probably prefer to be talking about other things during the final weeks of your campaign. So
right.
In your particular race, so this is the 16th district in Pennsylvania State Senate. What are you campaigning based on?
You know, one of the big things is the Anti-Corruption Act. So there's an American Anti-Corruption Act that's out there. And really, it talks about multiple things. But one big thing is getting big money out of politics. So I think that this is a big problem. You know, the guy that I'm running against has been taking money from the pharmaceutical industry, from the oil and gas industry. And we really need to be able to stop that from happening. And so, in fact, you know, I'm very pro amending the Constitution so that we can fix this problem, not just at a state level, but also at a national level. That's probably number one. Number two, of course, is ranked choice voting, which I think will help both the Democrats and the Republicans be a little bit more faithful to their audiences. And ranked choice voting, of course, is, you know, being able to vote for more than one person. So if your first person doesn't win, perhaps your second choice win, perhaps your third choice would win.
Yeah, well, don't worry. I'm sure a lot of our viewers are probably in favor of both of those things. So I'm curious, in a state Senate race, obviously we talk about campaign finance and, you know, how these donations can shape outcomes in Congress and all of that. Yep. At the state Senate level, is it as big of a concern? Like, are corporations stepping in and having an outsized influence over these sorts of races too?
Absolutely. Yeah, they step in everywhere. Like, you know, in Pennsylvania, you could actually buy an election. So here in Pennsylvania, we have no limits on the amount that somebody could give to a candidate. So if you wanted to give $2 million to somebody, you could easily do that. And so you can see the kind of corruption that causes.
You know, I also wanted to ask you one question. So you're running in Pennsylvania. I know that Pennsylvania, in terms of their congressional districts, there's concerns about gerrymandering. That's been a big issue. In the state legislature, are there concerns about that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, almost all the state legislators are gerrymandered as well. And so whoever wins this state Senate race will be voting on the maps in 2020. So it's a big, important race.
Yeah, it's amazing that system can continue, not just in Pennsylvania, obviously, but across the country.
Everywhere.
There's such self-interest, obviously biasing the process. It's amazing that that's allowed to continue. But I also wanted to ask you about the relationship between, so you're running a state Senate in Pennsylvania. We know that congressional races have become much more national over the past few decades. Are you finding that a lot of the conversations nationally, politically, that are going on, are they influencing the dynamics of your specific race as well?
Well, certainly when I knock on doors, I mean, they're always talking about national issues, you know, and so when Kavanaugh, when that whole issue was going on, that's what you would hear about on the doors. When Parkland happened over a year ago, that's what you would talk about when you're headed on the doors. So yeah, it was primarily national issues, I would say. But what a lot of people don't understand is how those national issues can be dealt with at the state level.
Okay. Well, Mark Pinsley, thank you for joining us on the show. Certainly hope you...
You
have a good result in just a couple of weeks, and I also hope that your debunking of those false advertisements actually spreads throughout your district.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take one more break. When we come back, Ron DeSantis and Andrew Gillum had another debate down in Florida last night. There was one response in particular Andrew Gillum gave that was amazing, and we'll have that for you. Welcome to what remains of this episode of The Damage Report. I just wanted to give you a little bit of breaking news. During all of the breaks on the show, we do try to keep up with whatever's developing, especially on Twitter. And the latest that I've seen in the bombings that have gone over the past 48 hours is that apparently leads for the FBI have led, I guess, leads tend to Florida. And so at this point, again, no one has taken credit for this. And I don't know how strong the leads are, but investigators do believe that they might have been sent from Florida. And what's interesting is that while they say that a few of the bombs appear to have been hand-delivered, they also say that all 10, and I believe there have been 10 so far, did at one point or another go through the Postal Service. So I don't know exactly how those two statements are consistent, but that is what is coming out from the FBI right now, that it might, in fact, have come from Florida. And what's interesting is that, as we said yesterday, the return address on all the packages was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, congresswoman and former head of the DNC. We do not believe that she sent the packages, but it is interesting if the person ends up having used the same state that they are in fact coming from to attempt to frame Debbie Wasserman Schultz or draw attention to her or whatever. A bit of positive news. As of right now, it's been about an hour more, no extra bombs. So that's a good thing for America. Yay. Now, with that said, let's turn to Florida. The gubernatorial race between Ron DeSantis, Andrew Gillum, again, like many others, super high profile, very tight race, and very important. And since the primaries ended, has been marked from an incredible amount of just casual racism being thrown Gillum's way by DeSantis. We're going to go through a little bit of that. But this actually came up at their debate last night. Here's an interaction they had.
Mr. Gillum, I'll give you a chance to respond now.
Well, let me first say, my grandmother used to say a hit dog will holler. And it hollered through this room. Mr. DeSantis has spoken. First of all, he's got neo-Nazis helping him out in this state. He has spoken at racist conferences. He's accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim, N-I-G-G-E-R. When asked to return that money, he said no. He's using that money to now fund negative ads. Now, I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
Mr. DeSantis, if I would ask the audience.
Man, there are some people I would not want to debate against. So Ron DeSantis, during that answer, even before he got to the great line, obviously, that I want to focus on, looked like a combination of mad and kind of sad, and then obviously did not like it at the end. And since then, by the way, I believe Laura Ingraham has said that that's not a fair thing to say. They always try to say that. But I'm interested in reality. This program is one that is interested in reality. Does anyone doubt that what Andrew Gillum is saying there is true? That racists in Florida definitely think that Ron DeSantis has their back. Now, that response where he says, you know, hit dog will holler and all that, was in response to Ron DeSantis acting all indignant about these accusations that he has said racially insensitive, or I believe the term is racially conservative things, which is a great turn of phrase. Let's go back through just a few of the things. There was mention there of money being given. But in addition, back in August 29th, on an interview on Fox News Channel, DeSantis described Gillum as articulate while arguing that his policies would hurt Florida, warning, the last thing we need to do is monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state. Okay, so again, as we said at the time, who uses that expression, monkey this up? I'm not saying it's impossible, but it is a little bit odd that you say that he's both articulate and monkey this up. I mean, I guess those are technically code words, but the code is pretty easy to crack. And the Washington Post revealed last month that DeSantis had spoken four times at conferences hosted by the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Horowitz has said that African Americans owe their freedom to white people and that whites are the victims of the country's only serious race war. And so again, this is a thing where you do have to look at what the individual politicians are saying, but you can also look at the people that they choose to associate with. This has been the case with Congressman Steve King recently, who has spoken favorably about people, politicians in other countries, by the way, that have said incredibly racist things. I have a feeling they probably know a little bit about who they're endorsing. So there, he is speaking at a place that is, is based on this sort of weird ahistorical racism. He is accepting money from racists and refusing to give it back once it's revealed. He's making these sorts of comments that are pretty obvious. And throughout this election, as we showed yesterday, white supremacists from other parts of the country have been running robocalls and radio ads that are racist as well. We played one for you. We're not going to play it again, but it purports to be Andrew Gillum speaking in an incredibly stereotypical and racist way about blacks in Florida. So I think Andrew Gillum's approach is, I think, a good one. He is standing up for himself. He is making it clear who Ron DeSantis is without making the campaign about that. You get put in a pretty terrible position as an African-American politician where you're supposed to just accept this sort of racism. And if you complain about it, if you make a big deal out of it, you are in fact attacked for that. I think he's walking a very careful line here. At the end of the day, I don't know how much it matters that you accurately depict Ron DeSantis as a racist. I think that the people who are going to vote for him in Florida, I think very few of them will see that to be a big negative, I think. And that is sort of what Gillum was getting at there. In addition, he is doing, I think, more outside of the racism to tie Ron DeSantis to Donald Trump. In this particular case, that has been a very easy case to make because, as we showed you, Ron DeSantis is the guy that ran that ad of him reading Donald Trump's book to his son and having his kids assemble a wall. Oh my God, I can't believe how quickly you guys got to that B-roll. But like Ron DeSantis wants you to believe that he is indistinguishable from Donald Trump. Now, the question is, in Florida, does that actually help Ron DeSantis? Or does it actually help Andrew Gillum? Gillum seems to believe that it is a net negative. And so he has been going out of his way in every area he can to tie the two together. It's going to be interesting to see when it comes down to election day if that actually works. Now, the latest polling we have yesterday, Gillum was up at 51 to DeSantis's 46. So I believe that was a Gravis poll. Just 12 days out from the midterm, he's up by 5. There's a lot of polls, though. And at the end of the day, we really don't know. We were talking about that in the interview about Beto O'Rourke. Turnout patterns appear so far from both the primaries and from the early voting in this general election to be different than they have been historically. Midterms are typically very low turnout elections. That does not look like the case. In the primaries, turnout in many of these cases was as high as it was back during the 2016 presidential election, an election that many people were invested in on a daily basis. So it's going to be really interesting to see. will somehow the shy Trump voters who supposedly aren't telling pollsters how much they love people like DeSantis turn out? And then this poll turns out to overstate Gillum's support? Or will Democratic turnout be as big as the indications appear to be at this point? We'll have to wait 12 days and find out. With that said, thank you for watching the show. If you haven't already rated the podcast, please do so on iTunes. It's so helpful to us. And thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow to close out the week with our Friday episode of The Damage Report. Thank you for listening to The Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.